I thought of talking about counterfactual historical like reasoning and then contrast that to fictional modeling, but then I started to think, maybe I concentrate entirely on fiction. And so now that we were here discussing about ideal types and then as-if reasoning, so I think, I mean, fiction next is just, you know, a natural, thing to then discuss after these notions. And I have a small case. I'm afraid I don't have too much time to linger on this case, but I have a case of Milton Friedman versus James Tobin, and so we also can discuss a little about his actual work, because he's actually a very empirical researcher when it comes to his work in economics. And so this is Mark Plough, a very well-known methodologist of economics, British. There was this TV series in which there was this slogan, "No sex, we are British," and so this is a kind of a version of this. And my outline here is that I'm first going to talk a little bit about fiction in economics actually, I mean, in the context of the question of the unrealism of the assumptions issue, I mean, that's the way of how realism of the assumptions issue, actually. I mean, that's the way people doing methodology of economics often talk about it. Then I switched to a fiction in philosophy of science, I mean, the various perspectives to fiction in philosophy of science. I mean, it's actually like, once again, a topic that philosophers of science are talking about. I mean, we had Weidinger, and then at some point we had Arthur Fine talking about fictions. And now then there are several philosophers talking about fictions seriously, and especially in the context of modeling. And then I have this case, and hopefully I end up being able to talk about that too. I mean, I realize there are a lot of topics here in my outline. So the realism of the assumptions issue in economics, I mean, it basically concerns all these problematic assumptions. And usually, I mean, when it comes to other sciences, you don't that much criticize them. But when it comes to economics, all of us are economic agents, and kind of we tend to think that we know our economy. And so all these problematic assumptions like profit maximization actually seems to be less problematic nowadays when it comes to economic reality. So I remember, I mean, some 20 years ago, I was in Helsinki School of Economics and Business Administration, and those times we were taught that actually firms have other goals than just the profit maximization, but those times are over, unfortunately. So, reality maybe has become somehow closer to economic theory. But then there are all these other things, perfect information, perfectly competitive markets, and so on. And then the issue is, well, are such assumptions too unrealistic? Or are they perhaps sufficiently realistic? Or whether that should matter at all? And so, we've been now abundantly discussing about methodological instrumentalism, and it has been claimed, and I do agree, that maybe, I mean, that's not the right label when you talk about Friedman. I mean, there are so many other aspects in his work. And then also, I mean, the thing that, oh my goodness, I wanted to point here, so I'm pointing like this. So the thing that seems to me that draws this closer to the notion of fiction is precisely the use of this as-if operator in his work. And of course, there are many philosophers and economists alike who have been discussing fiction in economic theory. So here we have Fritz Makloff. This is from his from a collection of his writings, but these writings are actually from the 1960s. And then he claims, maintains that consumers and firms that are being referred to in economic theory, they actually do not refer to real individuals and business enterprises. And he uses then also, I mean, this notion of an ideal type. And he says that really, I mean, homo economicus needs to be really clearly distinguished from real types. And it's really an artificial device that is being used in order to, theorize economically. So we have a heuristic device, and what it's supposed to be doing, it's supposed to be tracing out the predictive reactions of imagined agents. I mean, pay attention to imagined agents, to the imagined changes they face in the actually imagined behave with the environment. And so then we have, I mean, and this is also a very, very well known and quoted passage from Robert Lucas Jr., an economist who is now then explaining, I mean, his kind of economic theorizing, and he says, a theory is not a collection of assertions about the behavior of actual economy, but rather an explicit set of instructions for building a parallel or analog system. I mean, some kind of ideas of engineering are creeping in here. So, I mean, this kind of idea of a theory as an explicit set of instructions for building parallel or analog system. And then he goes on, a mechanical imitation economy, a good model from this point of view will not be more real than a poor one, but it will provide better imitations. And then he says, of course, what one means by better imitation will depend on the particular questions. And actually here, the italics are mine, which one wants to have answers. And so finally then we have Robert Sugden, who is a game theorist himself, and he's against of this kind of idea that that one could approach economic theorizing and you know the question of unrealistic assumptions in terms of the idea of isolation or then abstraction. He's against that. So this is kind of a powerful defense of economic theorizing presented, for instance, by Uskalimäki. Later on also, at least about the same time, by Nancy Cartwright. Although, I mean, nowadays it seems as if she doesn't approach economics in that way anymore. So she has from 99 this paper which has the title The Vanity of Rigor in Economics, and she thinks that it, you know, economics doesn't work in the same way as physics, and that's why, I mean, one of this, like, part of this rigor, it's somehow, like, you cannot justify it at least in the same way as you can justify that in physics. I mean, that's what this paper is all about. And Sugden pretty much agrees. He's discussing the Schelling model of racial segregation, and basically, I mean, the checkerboard version of this. You have this checkerboard, and then you have these checkers, and then by moving these checkers, then you basically, I mean, the idea there is that, the checkers might represent, for instance, two different races or groups of people. And then what he wants to show, I mean, Schelling shows there that only a mild preference to have then your neighbors like you might lead to a very like segregated neighborhood. So that's what's going on in this model. And then Robert Sugden uses this as an example, and he says, just what do we have to seal off to make a real city, say Norwich, to become like a checkerboard? And he thinks that this is not a useful way to think about economic models like this. And now I have to qualify, because I think that there are many kinds of models and many kinds of modeling. So I'm here basically talking about very idealized, very simplified economic models, typically some mathematical models. And you have these kinds of models, of course, in other areas. So recently, I mean, the last years I've actually been working with systems and synthetic biology, and clearly there, I mean, many like basic models, they are so simplified. So one has to some extent the same kind of problems there. But here, I mean, Sugden, he then concludes that a model is a parallel reality. It creates a feel for why this regularity happens. I've been discussing a lot with him, and he's talking about this kind of a sort of expertise that you get by creating these models and then getting this kind of idea how this might be working. And he thinks that part of that might even be visual, and part of like this modeling expertise is like an ability to think about this system in these terms. And then he comes close to this kind of idea that models are fictions. And then he thinks that, I mean, when we usually appreciate, assess such models, say for instance game theoretic models, which are quite far removed from anything, any real situations, then we actually are pretty much like assessing them as we assess the realisticness of a novel. I mean, that is what he claims here. And then he talks about credibility. And then he says that we can compare the housing markets of different cities, the real world, and we can think about the real world as like an immensely complicated model. And since we can, you know, compare these different housing markets in different cities, and so why couldn't we then compare the housing markets in this kind of analog economy with then housing markets in some particular city? I mean, that's his basic idea here. And so then, so clearly, I mean, these examples show that they have something like fiction in mind, these writers, when they talk about economic modeling and try to also justify what's happening here. Oh my goodness.
You just need to go on to the
end. Yes, I'll go. This one's too.
There we go. Yeah.
Yep. So.
I should have. Yes. So basically then, I would say, within the last 10 years, philosophers of science have become, again, really, really interested in the notion of fiction. And one of the reasons is that, Peter Godfrey Smith points out nicely, that models often take themselves to be describing imaginary populations, biological populations, imaginary neural networks, I would say rather artificial neural networks, by the way, and then imaginary economies. So these are the kinds of examples he says. And then Martin Thompson-Jones talks about so-called missing systems. And he writes, scientists often think and talk as though there are systems which fit the descriptions models contain perfectly, despite the recognition that no actual concrete systems do so. And so the kinds of systems that scientists are describing are in some sense missing. There aren't such systems, and that is the reason why then he also talks about fiction. But there are some general problems with the idea of fiction, and this might be the reason why many philosophers of science, you know, aren't really embracing this notion. Now, one is the ontological like freakishness of fictions. I mean, where are these fictions supposed to be? I mean, how are we supposed to understand the notion of fiction? And then, of course, there are people like Ronald Gehry who say that the rationality of science might be difficult to defend if now philosophers of science start to talk about science in terms of fiction. And I think, I mean, that's a valid point. But in a sense, I think I will suggest, I mean, part of that is due to the fact that we approach fiction, you know, through maybe mistakenly the idea of fiction being something which is not the case or false or anything like that. So I would say that for the moment, like the most popular accounts of fiction in philosophy of science are imaginary accounts, and you know, from this point of view, models are imaginary, unreal, or even false. And there are two versions of that. And the first version draws upon Gendall Wallstone's pretense theory, which is actually not presented in the context of philosophy of science, but in the context of philosophy of literature. And the reason this is used by philosophers of science, I think, is that this provides a solution to the problem of the ontological kind of status of fictional entities, because basically here what is being claimed is that there are not such things as fictional entities. So they are, you know, fictional characters, they are just props in the game of make-believe. And then on the other hand, we have people like philosophers like Peter Godfrey Smith, who doesn't think that you need to somehow solve this ontological problem of fictional entities, and he approaches the models as imagined concrete things. And the idea is that these are things that are imaginary or hypothetical, but would be concrete if they were real. It's a really interesting claim. I've tried to understand what this could mean, because I'm actually nowadays dealing with research on synthetic genetic circuits, and it seems to me that the people in the field of synthetic biology approaching these things as some sort of models, but they are concrete. I mean, they are really constructed in the lab on the basis of mathematical models. So that's happening there. Anyway, so there are several pending problems if you start approaching fiction in this way. And the first is, people have different kinds of imaginings. So, I mean, how are we going to deal with the variation of the imaginings of different scientists? I mean, this is pointed by Michael Weisberg. And then, of course, I mean, many models that we are dealing with in science are such that it's really, like, difficult to understand them in terms of imagination. I mean, we use some very complicated computer models, and they are pretty much opaque to a researcher. But of course, I mean, this also has been a point. I mean, I have colleagues in Helsinki who have claimed, they are philosophers of economics, who have claimed that maybe this could partly explain the economist preference for mathematical simplified models, because you somehow can have kind of an idea of what's going on, you know, when your model, I don't know. I mean, I don't have an answer to that. I don't know if that's the case, but that's what they are claiming. But from my point of view, what is the fundamental problem in approaching models in this way is that this imaginary account, it distinguishes between the scientist's imaginings and then what they call model descriptions. So you have the model like, you know, this, like, say, a group of equations, and, you know, that's the model description. It's on the paper, and at the same time, you're supposed to be having something in your head, which is, you know, your imagined system, and they are somehow, you know, like distinguished from each other, and then even in such a way that the former is being prioritized. And this really creates, I think, big problems, because, I mean, the way, at least, I mean, if I'm thinking about how I became acquainted with the modeling when I was an economics student, so clearly I was presented a way in which I have to now start modeling this phenomena. And I'm thinking about this nearly in Kuhnian terms. There were some exemplars I had to apply them and try to model the phenomena in that way. And once you then went on doing that, you know, it started to make sense to you that, you know, this is the way in which you build models. But if this is the case, then it seems that first you have these representational tools, which have their, of course, I mean, their theoretical motivation and justification, and then you just have to learn how to use them in order to model them, and that then gives you the access to this imagined world. So, and because of that, then I'm in the process of trying to approach fiction in a different way, and so I'm thinking about fictions as specific kinds of artifacts, at least, I mean, fictions in science, and instead of trying to understand fiction in terms of unreal, false, or imaginary, I'm thinking about them as purposefully constructed entities, as artifacts, I mean, constructed with different kinds of representational tools. And this is an old idea, I mean, really old, because even the word fiction is derived from the Latin word fingere, meaning to form. So, I mean, to give form to some ideas from my thing, make use of culturally available representational tools. So that's kind of a different notion of fiction. So from this point of view, if you look at models and fictions, I'm not making the claim that models are fictions or anything like that, but it seems to me that there are many, several similarities between models and fictions, and one of them is that they are both constructed, like I argued here. So they have the abstract and concrete dimensions, but you cannot draw them apart in the way in which that there are imaginings, you know, somewhere in our heads, and then there are model descriptions, but somehow it seems that this model implies both this abstract dimension and abstract conceptual dimension, and then this use of these representational tools in which then this abstract content is embodied. And then what I think is important here is that they are partially autonomous. This is being stressed by several recent writers, writers on models. So for instance, Michael Weisberg talks about models as kind of independent entities, and Mary Morgan, Margaret Morrison, they talk about models as also at least partially autonomous. I mean, autonomous is the word they use. And I think, I mean, this autonomousness and independence part when it comes to modeling is that they present us self-sufficient systems of different interdependencies. And I think, I mean, models are, I'm referring partly to you, actually. They are, what is important of them as a particular class of representation is precisely their systematicity. They really make use of these systemic properties, I mean, these interdependencies, and then scientists, when they work with models, I mean, this is what Morrison and Morgan stressed, that you work with models, you manipulate them, you really, like, experiment these models. I mean, it is not just that you have this model which is supposed to be representing something outside of it, but much of the insight that we gain from models is from modeling, the process of modeling. And then finally, I mean, incompleteness. So these are kind of constrained small worlds which contain only selected features of the real world. But it doesn't mean that they contain these selected features in the sense that you start with some, you know, real system, you start abstracting, taking something away. No, I think, I mean, in most of the cases, you have some, like you mentioned, some empirical like data in mind, some like, well, maybe not data is, but some empirical phenomenon which already is to some extent known, and you'd like to explain that, and you have some theoretical ideas how you might be able to explain that, and then you build a system which is supposed to be reproducing what you actually like see in the real world, and if it's somehow successful, it should also be having some predictive power. So from this point of view, fiction doesn't need to be something which is false, but it's a small, independent, self-sufficient world, but the way in which we understand it, I mean, we need to take into account our knowledge of the real world, and of course, I mean, our previous theoretical and empirical knowledge. So that about that, and then I go to this case, so I'm like asking, what are these economic fictions, I mean fictional models, then good for? And so here we then go to Milton Friedman, this time as an economist, and he's made this really enigmatic statement: inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. What does this mean? And then sometimes he explains in the sense that it is and can be produced only by a more rapid increase in the quantity of money than in output. Now, is this a causal statement or not? It seems that economists in general agree that you cannot have inflation unless you really have an increase in the quantity of money. So this is being agreed, but not necessarily the causal claim that underlines there, because his causal claim is that actually, I mean, this is caused by the increase in the quantity of money that is such that could be controlled by central bank. I mean, that's the basic idea behind that. And so if we think about then this claim, so it needs to be understood in terms of his earlier studies of nominal income. And I think, I mean, and this once again relates to what you said in your presentation, there is no less than the self-stabilizing tendencies of the capitalist economy at stake. I mean, so there are some kind of ideas, I mean, how these things need to be. And so that's a kind of a conviction that lies also behind, I think, this Friedman F53, that, you know, he still thinks that actually, I mean, this these models, they capture something that is the case. Well, then he then there is this discussion on the causes and conditions of inflation in 1960s, because I mean that started to become a problem in 1960s. So we had the discussion then on inflation, and then the discussion was precisely about partly about the question whether the increase of money supply is a cause or is a cause, the cause, or just a condition of it. And some people then read Friedman as claiming that it is the cause of it. And some people claim, yeah, it's one of the causes. I mean, that much was actually admitted by all the Keynesians, that yeah, it can be one of the causes, but there are several other causes. And Friedman was taken to claim that it is the cause. And then there were some people who were claiming that, well, it's just a condition of it. So, I mean, they were making a distinction between a cause and a condition. So, in order to be a cause, it really has to be something that, like, could be an independent determinant, or not just, you know, something that is caused by something else, like the Keynesians claim. I will go into it. And it's interesting here, I mean, I was thinking about this, I mean, the way he was quoting all the terms. So there is this cautiousness also when it comes to his economic work. So he's really cautious about any explicit causal language. He doesn't, you know, in his economic writings talk about causes. So it's about directional influences, primacy of money, or independence of money. These are the kinds of expressions he's using. And then his primary evidence for this primacy of money is very empirical. So he has single equation time series regressions of economic aggregates in order to show that monetary aggregates explain better the variations in money income than the Keynesian multiplier. And then he has evidence on the timing of leaps and lags at cyclical turning points. And finally, he has this really massive book on the monetary history of the United States, which he uses as evidence for the primacy of money. And so enter James Tobin to this discussion, and he attacks these Friedman's causal claims, presenting two models, the ultra-Keynesian model and then a Friedman world, as he says. And this, I will claim, is a modeling exercise and very different in what Friedman, from what Friedman is doing. So the ultra-Keynesian model, it's a very fictional construct. It presents 9 equations that then presents a very simplified imaginary economy. And you know, if you have been studying economics, you know, I mean, the way he goes on constructing this imaginary economy. It's really simplistic, and knowing that he was an monetary economist, I mean, it's really simplistic when it comes also to the monetary sector of this world. And then he says that, I hasten to say that I do not believe that the ultra-Keynesian model, I do not believe the ultra-Keynesian model to be exhibited. This is what he says. And he even then says that he doesn't even think that this ultra-Keynesian model represents adequately the Keynesian theory. So it's really very simplified model. And at the same time, then he presents a Friedman world. And his point here is that in this ultra-Keynesian model, the changes in the money supply respond passively to the income changes generated by autonomous investment and government expenditure. And yet, and here comes, you know, the beef, every single piece of observed evidence that Friedman reports in his previous empirical works is consistent with the timing implications of the ultra-Keynesian model. He's not trying to represent reality. He's constructing this device in order to show that Friedman implies with his empirical findings that the fact that, you know, a substantial money, increase in money supply always preceded inflation, so that seems to imply for Friedman and many others that the independence of money supply, or you know, the fact that money supply would have been a cause of inflation. And then he points out that that Friedman's observations can be generated by a structure in which money has no causal role. What's happening here? I'm once again.
Yes, okay.
Okay, I'm nearly like in the end of this talk. Friedman wasn't happy about this modeling exercise, and he thought, I mean, his like primary evidence for the claim of the primacy of money was the study of individual historical episode, which then, to his mind, showed that actually it was in the hands of the Fed to decide how to, about the money supply, and basically to decide how to respond to happenings in economy. So he thinks that the study of these individual historical episodes is the best evidence for the independence of money supply. And he even talks about crucial experiments. And he claims that, you know, these policies and measures taken by Federal Reserve system, they actually very importantly influence the economy. And he even then goes on to claim that if Fed had acted differently, some of these inflations and then recessions would have been like avoided, or at least they wouldn't have been that dramatic. So that's his claim. So now, I mean, I just want to end up this talk with a contrast between this kind of counterfactual historical reasoning of Friedman and then fictional modeling by James Tobin's. So in this Friedman's possible world, everything else remained the same except the actions of the Fed. He goes on really discussing, I mean, what happened in the Fed and why did they make this decision, and then he also wants to show that they could have acted otherwise. I mean, it wasn't that they were forced to act in this way. And then what Tobin does is he creates a very simple fictional world to show that it is possible that the money supply is totally dependent on the determinants of income, even though its change preceded, you know, the changes in nominal income. And then finally, a tentative answer to the question of what's the point of constructing fictional models. So it seems to me that one crucial use of fictional models in economics and in other fields too, I mean, this seems to be applying also to many areas in biology, is the study of different kinds of theoretical possibilities. I mean, that's what you are doing when you are constructing models. But at the same time, the possibilities can be studied in different ways, as then this example of Friedman and Tobin shows. And I think, I mean, part of the problem of this unrealism of assumptions issue in economics is due to the way in which we expect that models should be evaluated in the same way, I mean, these fictional models, as some more realistic representations of economy. But once we see that many fictional models and simplified models, they actually are trying to accomplish quite different kinds of things, then we see that maybe, I mean, it's a different kind of set of criteria that we should be applying to modeling. Thank you.